shore.
Yes, it did. It came right across, right down over top of us, right there.
There is the Hurricane Landfall Project truck. It's all set up, strapped down. We're going to turn all the switches on in just a little while. Standing outside of the Chevy Tahoe, we are getting into the eye wall of Hurricane Gene right now. Four came in on shore here along the southeast coast of Florida.
These little bullet cams right here that we will use to record that surge.
It's about 9 o'clock now, central time, which means that if we set them up and turn them on right now, they'd run until about noon tomorrow.
Does thunderstorm activity appear to consolidate around that eye?
That is storm surge from the Atlantic Ocean, the overwash coming in.
You're listening to Stories from the Hurricane Highway, the weekly podcast series that takes an in-depth look back at over two decades of tracking hurricanes, technology, behind-the-scenes stories, and much more. I'm your host, Mark Suddeth. So glad you could join me, and thank you for supporting this exclusive podcast via Patreon. In this episode, we pick up where we left off with Season 1, as we begin our journey again down the Hurricane Highway in the epic year of 2005. Well, hello everybody. Good to have you back for the second season of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. And boy, oh boy, do we have a good one to start off from. This go-around, it is Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020, that I am putting this together. That is the drop date of this episode. And again, it's great to have you here. Thank you for supporting this through Patreon, one of the exclusives that we offer here that is not available anywhere else, and it's great to have you aboard. We're going to pick up on where we left off, but before we get to that, let's do a little bit of a recap of where we have come from up to this point in time. So we began the podcast series Stories from the Hurricane Highway a year ago in December of 2019, and the goal was to make a podcast available that really gets into the nitty-gritty of how I started this whole thing with Hurricane Track, the Hurricane Landfall Project, the many hundreds of thousands of miles driven, and all the experiences of those miles, the technology that was developed, the people that we met along the way, those details that you would only get if we were to hang out, you know, and just start chatting around the campfire, so to speak, or over dinner somewhere, dinner after dinner after dinner, I guess, because we're talking many, many, many years of stories. And that's what this has been all about. We started off at the very beginnings of my career, how I got into all of this, the education background, early experiences, early influences from people. And we made it all the way through the 90s, the early 2000s, and up through the year, the very busy year of 2004. And I left off with sort of the teaser at the end of season one of the podcast that we would be getting into the year 2005 this December. And here we are. So where do we start? First of all, you remember, if you think back, 2005 was the busiest season to date at the time. And we had a total of 28 named storms, a very high ACE index that year, very damaging hurricanes. Most notably, of course, was Katrina. That was also the year of Rita and Wilma. 2005 was also the first year that we went into the Greek letters, exhausting all 21 letters of the normal list of names that we use. And we went into the Greek alphabet, and the season actually went on past November through December and into January of 2006, believe it or not. They just kept coming and coming and coming. So this first episode that we're going to resume Stories from the Hurricane Highway with, we're going to talk about the ingredients of the mega season. What were the aspects of the 2005 season that made it so busy? And that is what we will get into in this episode. Well, now I want to bring in my colleague Greg Nordstrom from Mississippi State University. He and I are going to speak over Zoom, so the audio is going to be a little different. Greg, thanks for joining me. I appreciate you being a part of the podcast. How you doing?
I'm doing well. It's great to be here, and it's good to talk about hurricanes.
Exactly. That's the topic of the day. And so We look back at other seasons besides 2005. Before we get into the ingredients, what are some other really what we call mega seasons that stand out in your mind that go above and beyond your typical active season? What would some of those past seasons be before we jump to 05?
Well, one that comes just off the top of my head is the 1933 season, which, if I am correct, I believe that's the highest ace ever accumulated in a hurricane season. And what to me makes that so exceptional is, what did we not have back in the 30s? We didn't have satellites, right? So unless it, you know, was going through a shipping channel, or, you know, there was actual observations of a storm, my question is, how many more storms were out there that, you know, we couldn't quote unquote see? So to me, 33 really stands out. I believe it was 20 named storms that year. So not quite the same number as 2005. But when you look at the ACE, ACE was actually ahead of it. And that's without satellites and really knowing how many true storms there was.
So from 1933 to 2005, we had other big seasons. But then all of a sudden, the year 05, as we now know, until the year 2020, had the record for the most named storms, tremendous amount of damage. That was surpassed by 2017, interestingly enough. But until all of that, until 17 and then this year, 2020, 05 stood alone. And there was a reason why that season was as busy as it was. And since that's where we're picking up on with this resumption of stories from the Hurricane Highway, we're looking at 2005. So think back. Let's go back in time now, 15 years. And think about April 05. What did we have? We had, you know, we had the internet, right? We had, you know, access to the web. We had satellite data. We had information from people like Colorado State University. Dr. Bill Gray was still alive at the time. We had private weather firms, but we didn't have social media like we do now. You know, Facebook had just been invented, 04, somewhere around there. Twitter wasn't really a thing yet. We had message boards, we had websites, we had blogs, we had television, weather. And so the forecasts for the 05 season, if you can think back, they were basically focusing in on what ingredients?
Well, there are several. First was the water temps. And I believe at the time it was the highest recorded. I think 2010 was even warmer water temp wise. But the MDR was really, really warm. And a lot of the warm water was packed close in the Caribbean, the Gulf, the eastern and southeastern part of the United States, which I think played a factor later in the season, you know, when you saw later in the season where you had more in-close developments. You had a lot of moisture. You weren't seeing a lot of dry air. Of course, you had the Sahel coming off Africa, which is typical. But in general, the atmosphere was pretty moist. You weren't seeing the vertical wind shear. And also back then, if you think about it, you know, because technology in 15 years has really changed dramatically, and the models are so much better now than they were even 15 years ago. A lot of it was pattern recognition, and that's becoming a lost art. You would look at the water temps, but not just above water temps, where they were focused. And there's something called the Atlantic tripole signature. And that was another thing that I was looking at that year, where it's not just you have the warm water, that focus of warm water was coming from the MDR, through the Caribbean, into the Gulf, and off to Southeast U.S. And it's almost like this alley, this unimpeded alley of rising, you know, energy and rising motion towards the United States. And, you know, a lot of the old school forecasters used to look at that setup, and when they saw that, they're like, you know, this is going to be an active season.
So we go back 15 years, and there were signals, even without the sophisticated climate models that we have today. They did exist to some extent back then. And even in March, April, May of 2005, we don't know as much as we know now in advance, but there were some pretty clear-cut signals, and different entities, private sector, public sector, you know, Colorado State. Similar to 2020, we saw the 05 season kind of coming well ahead of time, didn't we? It was well telegraphed.
Yes, definitely. I mean, again, yes, we were limited 15 years ago compared to what we're seeing today, but there is clear signatures. Again, with the water temps, the lack of wind shear, moisture. I mean, hurricanes, they like warm water, moisture in the atmosphere, and the lack of wind shear. And if you put that together, the next piece of the puzzle is, where do these storms form, right? If you look back like 2010, they form further out in the eastern Atlantic. So what happens a lot of times is when they get going too quick, these storms tend to recurve out to sea, right? The majority of the storms that really affect us and hurt us here in the United States are the ones that form close. Of course, we do get the long track ones. You do see the Cape Verde hurricanes, you know, some of the, like the 1928 Lake Okeechobee, or, you know, those type of storms, you get those things. But in general, you're going to get the more in-close development. And that is where the Bermuda or the subtropical high is really going to play a factor. And that was another key with 2005, was we had, for the most part, not the entire season, but for a lot of the season, the placement of that high really prevented these storms from curving out. And with them forming closer, it just, again, had that alley, which is connected to that tripole signature, where they were forming in the Caribbean, and it was just a train of them coming towards the United States.
So you mentioned the tripole signature. Expand upon that and try to describe for us what exactly is a tripole signature.
It's something you're going to see before the season really gets going, because when you get in those hyperactive season, mega season, really the water becomes above normal all over the place. But early, you know, before it gets going, you know, April, May, I always like looking at the sea surface anomalies, okay? And you got to be careful, because even if an anomaly is showing it's colder, it doesn't necessarily mean the water's cold. It's just colder.
It's a departure from some kind of an average or a normal.
Yeah, exactly. But I look at these anomalies, and the pattern you're looking for is that warm pocket, that above normal water from the MDR moving through the Caribbean into the Gulf and the Southeast United States. Then you want a colder pocket, more in the central Atlantic. And then above that, you got another warm pocket more in the northern Atlantic. And that signature, in general, tends to cause hurricanes to form to kind of move towards us. And again, it's just an unimpeded path of rising motion and energy that really is just pointed right towards the United States. And does it always work perfectly? No, because nothing in weather ever works perfectly. But that is a clear-cut sign and something that old-school meteorologists have been looking at for 50-plus years, that when you see something like that, that's typically going to show you the path of the storms and also the placement of the high that's going to block a lot of these storms from escaping.
As we know, the 2005 season gave us several very powerful hurricanes. And the interesting thing is, the ones that made landfall that were so devastating, starting with Dennis was darn near a Category 5. And then, of course, Katrina, in terms of United States impacts, reached Category 5 at one point. That was followed in September by Rita. And then in October, at the end of October, we had Wilma, also a Category 5. And in July there, around the same time as Dennis, we also had Emily, which made landfall down in, I think, the Yucatan. Ultimately, it reached Category 5 at one point. But the point is, we had these four Cat 5 hurricanes in the western part of the basin that they didn't track like the year before. 2004, you know, 2004, we had long track hurricanes like Ivan that became Category 5, and they developed way out early. Whereas the ones in 2005, your Katrina, your Rita, your Wilma, your Dennis scenarios, those hurricanes really didn't get going and reach their peak intensity until they were west of 70 to 75 degrees longitude. And so there was only a short amount of time, really, before they made landfall. What was the reason behind that, if you can recall and kind of think, you know, yeah, we didn't have Ivan, Francis, where they just come trucking across the Atlantic. And we think about years since then, 12 years later, 2017, Irma, Maria, powerful hurricanes way out in the main development region, the MDR, as you call it. We didn't really have that for the ones that had the biggest impact on the United States in 2005. Can you kind of think back and, you know, why was that? Why did they become such late bloomers?
Well, just to keep it simple, I mean, these long track storms are rare. While some of the most famous ones are long track, I think 1900 was another long track one, if I remember correctly. These storms have to traverse the entire Atlantic, and there's so many, if you want to call, landmines in the way, right? So in general, 9 out of 10 hurricanes that form east of 35 west longitude, they typically go out to sea, okay? But that 1 out of 10 will make it. So it's difficult. You know, you got to get through the islands. Think how many hurricanes Hispaniola, which is not good for them, but it's spared the United States. So you got that, you know, blockade of islands. You got a huge path of ocean where you have, you know, it's not like you have high pressure blocking it the whole way. You'll have little segments where there's a weakness and that storm will move off to the north. It's called a tut. And that tut sometimes will grab it and basically, to keep it simple, pull the hurricane out. Even with Irma in 2017, you notice that it actually dove to the southwest, which is kind of unusual. So there's a lot of landmines in the way. It depends on where the high pressures are at. It depends on the exact track. It depends on if there's a pocket of shear that opens it up and you get drier entrainment. There's just a lot of things. I mean, to get a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, atmosphere has to be basically perfect. And then on top of that, it's got to get through all these, you know, again, landmines on the way towards the United States. So with 2005, you did have storms that formed out in the Eastern Atlantic. It's just most of those that formed went out. They didn't make it the whole way. The ones that formed close to the United States, that's typically the hurricanes that hit the United States form within 5 days of the United States. So when these storms are forming close, there's less chance for it to hit those landmines. You know, if it's forming in the Western Caribbean and it starts moving north, it's not going to go through Hispaniola. And even if it starts to curve, at that point, it's still got to get through Florida. It's still going to affect the East Coast of the United States. So when they form close, what made 2005 really impressive to me was, I know the ACE wasn't quite as high as 1933. I believe it's still second all time, 2005. But most of that ACE was accumulated near the United States, and that's what makes it really dangerous. And you saw that also in 2020. We didn't get the long track ones, but that ACE was accumulating, even though it wasn't, you know, top five or anything, but still the majority of that ACE was accumulating near the US. And again, you know, look at Katrina, formed right off Florida, and we know how bad that got. We just got lucky that it went through, you know, eyewall replacement before landfall. Rita, same thing. It got going pretty quickly there. I mean, when they get going close to the United States, it's hard for them to miss.
Well, I find it fascinating that as we look back at the 05 season, there was really a very small chance from the experts. Climate Prediction Center was looking at it, that we just came off the 04 season, which itself was incredibly destructive, a lot of activity, those long track hurricanes. And you know, the odds that that was going to happen again or exceed it in 05 was basically only 1%. It's true. I was looking it up the other day, trying to refresh my memory on it. And yet it exceeded 04, which was incredible. And it was interesting to note some of the different factors. And we've learned a lot since then, in the 15 years since 2005, that when you have a tropically convective, inactive dateline region of the Pacific, in other words, and another way to put it is no El Nino and an inactive Pacific, the Atlantic tends to be the one that takes over. And it's interesting that in 05, anytime there was a deep convection, whether it spawned a named storm or not, out near the dateline around 180 degrees longitude in the Western Pacific, there was a lull in Atlantic activity. And anytime that convection near the dateline was squashed, the activity in the Atlantic was on fire. It was just incredible. And it seemed like it was about every 30 days. And what do we call that phenomenon? Now that we know a lot more, I mean, we knew about it then, but that phenomenon that circles the globe about every 30 days or so, that was prevalent in 05. And you know what I'm talking about?
MJO.
Yeah, the Madden-Julian Oscillation. And we've learned so much more about it now in the 15 years prior. But boy, that teleconnection there, that the the ebbs and flows of what happens in the Pacific absolutely impacts what happens in the Atlantic. But I got to tell you, Greg, I'm still, you know, 15 years later, absolutely stunned that the amount of Cat 5 activity west of 70, 75 degrees longitude that, you know, wasn't like we had a whole bunch of Category 5s out in the open Atlantic. All four Category 5 storms that formed in the western part of the basin. That was incredible. It really was. And, you know, 15 years later, we almost kind of repeated it in 2020, but we get to 2020 in another podcast.
No, going with what you're saying, it is exceptional. And sometimes, you know, weather records are made to be broken. And you know, let's be realistic. It is as good as we're getting, and as technology improves, we still have a limited data set. You know, yes, you can go back to, you know, the Spanish flu, and you could go back to the 14, 15, 1600s and definitely see how these storms, you know, within reason, where they were and what they affected, but they had to affect people in order for you to get that information. But, you know, you really look at it, we don't have a huge data set. And then going back to what you were saying, if you just keep things simple, and I think a lot of times people overcomplicate stuff. If you keep things simple and you just think of it rationally, it makes sense. If you look at the globe, in 2/3 of tropical activity occurs in the Pacific, and now the Pacific is not producing these storms, well, what's the point of hurricanes and typhoons and cyclones? What's the point? It's to take heat out of the tropics and redistribute it to the mid-latitudes and then even further north into the poles, right? That's a natural process that the Earth does. Well, if you have a natural process in an area of the world where 2/3 of this process usually occurred is not occurring, the globe tends to have a way to make up for that. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Without that activity in the Pacific, if you look, and this is something you can go back historically and see time and time again, does it always work perfectly? No. But in general, if the Pacific is not active and it's well below normal, the Atlantic's going to make up for that. And again, it's just a natural process of redistributing the heat from the tropics to the mid-latitudes.
So we know what the ingredients were going into the 2005 season. They were pretty well seen ahead of time, even 15 years ago, with the technology that we had, the climate modeling and so forth. And as early as December 5th, 2004, you know, not long after the 2004 season wrapped up, agencies like Colorado State University, led by Dr. Bill Gray as a lead author at the time on those forecasts, you know, they were calling for an above average season as early as December. And then those forecasts were revised through the spring of 2005 and in the end of the summer. And then by August, it was obvious what was happening. And it became more of, you know, well, these are memos from the Department of the Obvious than a forecast, because it was happening. It was already happening. And we were exceeding records in August when their last of the updates came out. And we know what happened. We ended up with 28 named storms, 27 official names, and then the 28th was kind of added later. So we had 28 tropical storms or higher is what it comes down to. And truly an historic season. With severe impacts, you know, many billions of dollars in damage, and more than 3,900 people were killed. And, you know, the damage was $170 billion plus back in 2005 dollars. Most of the Gulf Coast was affected. The Carolinas was affected. Florida, you know, was affected by Katrina. And it was one of those seasons that we thought, you know, it just can't get any worse than this. And of course, now we know it certainly can. And we get to that in future episodes. But it's interesting because as I looked at the 2005 season coming off of the very busy 2004 season, I thought 2005 can't be any worse than 2004. I mean, good grief. We had six different landfalls in 2004 that I was a part of, if I recall. Could 2005 top that? And it most certainly did. Well, now that we have refamiliarized ourselves with the ingredients that made up the historic 2005 season, and a big thanks to Greg Nordstrom for contributing his insight to that, We're going to go back to the very beginning of 2005 in next week's episode of Stories from the Hurricane Highway, and we're going to pick up quite literally where we left off at the end of 2004. We needed to make some changes. I will talk about that. We're going to introduce a new character, if you will. I mean, it's a real person. But these are stories, Stories from the Hurricane Highway. That's the name of the podcast, right? And in stories, you have characters. And so we're going to be introduced to a new character who began working with Jesse Bass and myself in early 2005. We're going to say goodbye to somebody. We'll talk about that. And then we're going to really get into this major watershed, sort of serendipitous moment that led to the birth of our ability to stream live video. And when you hear about that, and by the way, I am hoping to continue what we started by having Greg going forward, and we'll have Greg again in the future, but other guests as well, instead of it just being me. I think that'll make for a more interesting and a more multidimensional podcast series. The overall format, I think, is going to be better than what I did for the first season, kind of learning and moving forward and doing better with it. So yes, we're going to bring in other people that were part of all of this. Instead of me telling you the stories, I will involve some of the people, as many of them that I can get. And we'll use the audio Zoom feature. Now that everybody is familiar with Zoom, the audio capabilities of that remotely for us to get together, I think is going to really help this podcast to be even more in-depth and more interesting, really, instead of just me. Let's bring in the other people, you know, quite literally, and we'll be doing that in episodes going forward. In terms of where this goes for this year, season two of the podcast, we start off here with 2005, and that was a huge year, obviously. We've got a lot of storms to get through, a lot of stories, a lot of technology, and that could take a couple of months. This podcast drops every week. Every Wednesday, you'll be able to look forward to a new episode. We talk about 05, probably get through 06, 07. Maybe the goal will be to get all the way through the 2008 season and kind of, because that was a big season as well, and kind of end there because there were some big benchmark things that happened. There's all these big milestones, right? There always are in everybody's lives. Everybody's story has these interesting milestones. And in our case, I guess they're more like mile markers going with the old Hurricane Highway metaphor, and we will talk about those as well. So I think maybe a goal by the time we get to the last Wednesday in May that we will wrap up the 2008 season and where we go from there. I think that's a good goal going forward. So that's what's happening in the weeks and months to come. Well, as always, it's great to have you tuning in. I appreciate your support through Patreon, not only of the podcast, but of course, of the entire project. The power of crowdfunding enables us to do so much, and it's really been a remarkable year, the year 2020. We started the podcast series at the end of 2019 into 2020, and you know, we're going to get to 2020 in the audio podcast someday. This is mainly for a retrospective of how we got here, and in this era, the era of crowdfunding, your support means so much to me. And I sincerely appreciate it, and I just want to make sure that you always know that. First and foremost, this is for you. It's made possible by you, and I thank you for making this a reality. So that'll wrap it up for this edition of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. Stay safe out there, and I will talk to you again next week. I am Mark Suddeth, HurricaneTrack.com. We'll talk again as Stories from the Hurricane Highway Season 2 resumes next Wednesday.